Batsegundo here, and there appears to be a concern for what I'm permitted to say and what I'm not permitted to say, to which I profoundly object. Perhaps this is why Elizabeth Crane's work appeals to me so. I don't see the critics eviscerating her for writing about zombies having sex, or a town in which everybody turns clear. I don't see them remarking upon the fact that there's not a single sign in an amusement park that would ever read, "You must be this happy to enter." Personally, I've never been happy to enter, and you wouldn't catch me in an amusement park, even if it meant all the no-strings-attached sex I want, and not having to pay alimony for life. Crane seems happier than a small child getting his first ice cream cone in the summer, so I remain somewhat confused and considerably conflicted.
All right, so I am here once again with Elizabeth Crane, who is most recently the author of You Must Be This Happy to Enter. Elizabeth, how are you doing?
I'm a little frazzled, yes. But otherwise all right.
Well, fantastic. I'm glad we can actually do this in person. I wanted to first of all ask you about the story My Life is Awesome and Great.
Yes.
Which uses exclamation marks quite effusively.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if this was your effort to reclaim the exclamation mark. I mean, it has a bit of a stigma these days, I would think, you know?
It is. It's underrated. It's underappreciated.
It really is.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was just having fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I do kind of think that there are personalities out there who are sort of over-enthusiastic and or over-optimistic about the state of their lives,
yeah.
And so I was sort of inspired by that. But I wasn't consciously thinking, like, it's time for Crane to bring back the exclamation point.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a certain kind of gusto because there's a perseverance here in
yes.
the constant That's... stream of sentences that all end with the exclamation
yes.
mark as all these woes are communicated.
Exactly.
You know?
That's
so,
what I was really trying to yeah, sort of say, yeah, like, that... I'm going to just carry on in the face of everything.
But it's not just that. I mean, there's this kind of interesting semantic quality because we have a scenario in which, well, we see all range of emotions through these sentences.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering if that was kind of the intent. Was it just fun?
It was. I mean, I think one of the things in general, like, to answer that question, and for a lot of the things that I was thinking about, was like, what does it mean to be happy?
Yeah.
And I think, like, my personal answer to that is that it's not one fixed thing where you just suddenly get happy one day. And,
yeah.
you know, you can have a lot of different range of feeling and experiences and good things and bad things going on at the same time and still feel joyful.
Yeah.
Some people obviously more than others.
Sure. I also wanted to ask you about Betty the Zombie because
yes.
there's a bit of a hook to this zombie tale because reality TV enters the equation. And it kind of got me thinking about Max Brooks's World War Z, which also had the hook of a reported journalism feel, and I'm wondering if really this is the only way to present zombies effectively in contemporary fiction. You need to have that extra tilt, you know?
Well, I did have to say I did notice that there was that zombies were sort of seemed to be making a resurrection. I don't know if you've taken a lot of art, but there was a period I was thinking. I think in an earlier draft, she was going to be a Yeti.
Instead. Oh, really?
Yes. Because my husband's an artist, and we go to a lot of galleries, and suddenly everywhere we went, in one form or another, there were Yetis
yeah.
everywhere in people's
yeah.
art, whether it was a big sculpture or a little embroidery or something.
How did you switch from Yeti to zombie?
I don't know. I just wasn't feeling it.
Really? Just abominable snowman. They just don't do it for you.
Yeah, something, it just wasn't working, and so I abandoned it and went in a whole new direction. She became a zombie.
You go into some interesting domestic situations there, which I found to be quite daring territory. It isn't often you see zombie sex, you know?
Yes, it's a little painful.
Yeah, yeah.
Ed doesn't enjoy it so
Yeah, you
much.
Kind of allude to the rigor mortis quality to that, too.
Yes.
I mean, I'm wondering, you know, this collection to me seems to push the envelope further than your other two collections.
I would say, yeah.
And there's also, I think you've managed to sort of shake off the DFW yoke
with this. I think so, yes.
There's more, I think you've found a particular voice that is, it reminds me sometimes of Amy Bender, reminds me sometimes of George Saunders, but I wanted to ask you, did you face problems? I mean, this is being published by Akashic as opposed to
right.
Little Brown, and I'm wondering why that happened. Is it because it was too crazy?
There's a long story about the shift. I don't think it was the craziness of the stories. I think it was the fact that they were stories, honestly.
They were what?
That they were stories.
Yeah.
You know, that in a lot of large publishing houses, making a commitment to someone who seems to be, from all we can tell so far, yeah. is exclusively a short story writer.
Yeah.
And when you look at the numbers, even if there's a certain amount of critical success, it doesn't really behoove them to take on a story collection time and time again. And so I parted ways with Little Brown for different, like, not because of the craziness of yeah. the stories, because actually they liked it. I certainly approached them about it. But no, I think it was more that it's sort of like two-part, and answered the question
yeah.
is a different story entirely. So.
Well, I mean, you know, what was it? Was it just really that being a short story writer in today's fiction atmosphere
yeah.
is just really something
yeah.
that
yeah.
you almost can't do as well?
It's,
I mean, how do you keep on going?
I think independent publishers are picking up the slack, and
yeah.
that's where a lot of the story writers are going. Or, you know, someone will give a collection to an independent publisher and sell a novel to a bigger house.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, marketing. It's just a lot about dollars and marketing and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The business model is so different with the indies, and I'm just beginning to learn about it.
Yeah.
But they have a chance of actually making their money back on
yeah.
this, and hopefully some profit.
Yeah.
Whereas with the big houses, for a story collection, the way that they sell, typically, if you get the kind of advance that I get, which was very nice,
yeah.
I have to say, it's in retrospect, now that I know more, really hard to earn that kind of money back for them.
Yeah.
So.
Makes complete sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if this is why you styled the last collection more as a novel and stories.
Well,
because of
that
this.
And that sort of is part of the problem of what went wrong
yeah.
With the last publishing with Little Brown, because I certainly didn't compromise what I was looking to do. I had always wanted to write a story about this one character.
Yeah.
But certainly to the extent that they had the opportunity to promote it as a novel in stories and really didn't.
Yeah.
And it was partly, in many ways it was nobody's fault. It was kind of a very happenstance kind of thing. My publicist disappeared at the exact wrong time.
Oh,
and
I see.
The ball was dropped and, you know, it was pretty unfortunate.
So. Going back to a slightly more pleasant
topic
here.
Yes.
Shaking off the DFW yoke and finding your voice. I mean, there is in the story notes for a story about people with weird phobias. That seemed to me almost a response to the DFW essay host. I'm wondering if that might be.
Oh, gosh. I don't know that one. Which one is that about?
That's the crazy one that appeared with colorful footnotes on the side.
Oh, that crazy one.
That was
yeah.
the only story in here that I was saying, oh, okay.
No,
you know.
I'll tell you what inspired that story was with Joyce Carol Oates' story.
Oh, really?
Called, it has a very long title, which I can't repeat, but it's Notes for a Paper on My Time in the Correction House or something. It was by a 16, like, the narrator is 16 years old, and
yeah.
it's written in the story. It's sort of like in an outline form, and then it has all these digressions and
yeah,
whatever,
yeah,
and so I thought that was really fun.
That's interesting. You should check out Host. It's really crazy.
I'm sure that I've read it at some point, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, going to this idea, I guess, of shaking off the DFW yoke, which I keep pressing
you're stuck
you
on that, man.
I am, because, I mean, I just really see that you have gone more for a conceptual angle with these stories, and you've gone more with the sort of exuberance that these characters are feeling more. I mean, and I'm wondering, what steps have you taken? I mean, have you just concentrated and dwelled more on concepts such as a man who is in a television who can be taken out, or Blue Girl,
well,
where you have block letters on the character.
Sometimes I'll have an idea like that, and I'll think, like, oh, what if someone... I mean, you know, Betty the Zombie is just like, whoa, what if a zombie was on a reality show?
Yeah.
And it goes from there. I have to say, like, some of the stories, like Blue Girl and the Ricky Ricardo story, were actually written back when I was writing.
Interesting.
Some of the... I would say that, like... two-thirds maybe are much newer, but
yeah.
several of them were older and didn't fit into other collections very well and whatever. But, you know, the main thing, actually, honestly, that I was trying to do here was to write some more stories that I would be able to read out loud.
Ah.
Because many of my... I was always sort of struggling to find something that was... had shorter sentences
yeah.
enough to sort of... It's one thing to read it on the page for a reader. It's not that hard to follow and trace back to the beginning of the sentence. But in a reading, I felt like I was losing my attention, you know, as I was reading, and so I didn't want my reader, my audience to be that distracted. So I really was, I just wanted stuff that was a lot easier to do at readings.
I'm wondering if this was because of the story that, the title story that was commissioned for Chicago Radio or Stories on Stage. Was this kind of a factor that led you thinking more in terms of what could be read? Or?
You know, I'll tell you what one sort of inspiration was. I don't know if you know the writer Joe Mino.
Yeah.
He's a local Chicago guy. He's also a public...
He writes theatrical plays before he writes the novels.
He's a man of many hats.
Yes.
And he, his stories, he's such a good reader, and his stories are just so kind of, the voice is always really strong. Mm-hmm. And so I was inspired by him. I was just like, he's always, like, whenever he goes to a reading, he just kicks it. And I was just like, I want to be able to have more than three stories in my book that I can just decide to read.
Yeah.
You know?
And yet there are three stories in this that are composed of nothing more than one ongoing paragraph, which can't entirely be easy to read.
One or I mean, two of
the
them.
Most everything in the world,
yes.
The banana story,
banana, yes.
And what 1 week was like. Those are all
yes.
one paragraph. So it seems to me that
yes.
There's a part of you that's resisting this
well,
reading quality.
I'll tell you, though, I read Banana Love last night, and I've read that several times, and that one's not that hard to read. And What Our Week Was Like, I may read tonight, and that's actually pretty easy to read, too. The Most Everything, the other one, I read once, but then I read that for the first night in Chicago, and the morning of, I said to my husband, you should read this with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I marked out all
really?
The lines, because it's almost all dialogue.
Yeah.
And he was like, all right. And I had a friend of mine put it on, you know, tape it, and it came out great. I'm actually trying to get it developed into a little short film.
Oh, interesting, interesting.
But it was so much fun. And so that's the kind of thing, like, I'm, you know, I don't have to have the stage all by myself. Like,
yeah. Well, for that story, I'm wondering if having everything delivered in one paragraph is a way to show this successful marriage unit.
Wow. See, this is what I love, when people come up with these inside, these little things and say, like, and then I can say, like, yes, I meant to do that. But... Really, I didn't think about
it. I'm just curious, what caused you to go and write these stories in one paragraph, as opposed to... I mean, because some of your stories often have one-line paragraphs and are just very dialogue-driven.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice observation that you made. I think sometimes I just really like to show the kind of seamlessness of the, you know, like the conversation as an organism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a new story that I brought to my writers group recently, and there's an argument in the story between a woman and a dog walker at the dog park. Just totally made up. And
based off personal experience?
No, just something I dreamed up. And I purposely wrote the dialogue of the argument, which is like two pages long, and she said, and just all, and I think just it adds to the intensity of it,
yeah.
You know, and shows this sort of like, that those women aren't necessarily as far apart as one might think that they are on the surface,
yeah.
And that may be the same, a little bit of that working in the marriage story as well.
Well, there's...
Because they have different opinions, clearly, about this desert island thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about while we're on the subject of marriages, and that is the tendency for many of your protagonists to be misfit, to be off-kilter in their thinking, and yet the new boyfriend is always the big thing that they're looking for. And this is interesting to me because you've been happily married, so I can understand.
I'm quite happily married,
yeah.
Yes.
Is it something about the misfit spirit that causes them to latch on to some just typical American construct? Like, oh, well, I'll be normal if I actually have the new boyfriend. And it always ends up invariably going wrong. You know?
Yes, yes. Well, you know what? It's an interesting subject to me. I mean, it's one that I've written about a little bit in, you know, marriage in various forms in this. And I'm still kind of wondering what marriage is to most people. I know what it is to me, and I know that I'm a misfit, and that most of the people that I know and like are not exactly, you know, don't fit into mainstream culture quite as easily as most. And so it interests me, like, how we all kind of try to do that and get by.
And yet, love is also predicated often on enclosed spaces. For example, Ricky Ricardo, you have a rather strange scenario there in which a man who is a couple inches high is then kept to a drawer and becomes the lover of the protagonist.
Yes.
Likewise with Donovan's Closet, which is a rather strange scenario in which this character is attracted to the closet.
Yes.
The idea of inhabiting that closet and also simultaneously connecting with her boyfriend while being in that closet.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you about why small, often rectangular spaces along these lines seem to me the way to explore this rather eccentric
I think for me it speaks a little bit to the fear of these of connections, you know, like with real actual people. It's, you know, the closet was like, oh, you know, on the surface it smells heavenly and she just like wants to get in there and hang out there because she feels good in there, but she's never had a real relationship before.
Yeah.
So even though it's good, the roof might cave in at any moment, so she's got that little place. And you know, similarly with the woman in Ricky Ricardo, like that, you know, she's connecting with a person. Well, I mean, that's more of like a sexual relationship, but the guy is this
big. It's a relationship. It works for some folks. It works for all of us at some point.
Exactly. So you know, it's not exactly what most people might consider to be a fully functioning relationship.
I'm wondering if it's a notion of being a misfit and yet finding another obstacle, being having your personality confined by a rectangular space or some sort.
Okay.
Feel free.
Sure, that works for me.
Well, yes, I had that all along. Okay, no problem. I also wanted to ask you, you alluded to the notion of happiness in many of these stories. I mean, Sally's opening line is, there is not one thing even a little bit sad about this story. And then, of course, we talked about My Life is Awesome and Great, which takes happiness to an often crazed level. And then, of course, the title story. I'm wondering, do you think that there isn't enough happiness in contemporary fiction? Is this your way to carve up your little mark here?
I definitely was aiming for that, because I don't think it's happiness as a subject is taken seriously.
Yeah, particularly in MFA workshops? Or
definitely not. But it's, you know, it's, I mean, which is not to say that you don't have to have some conflict for a story to be a little bit interesting. And there's obviously conflict in these stories, but I think happiness is as legitimate an experience in life as anything else, as pain, conflict, cancer, whatever the hell.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just doesn't, for some reason, I think as art, it's not seen that way.
Yeah.
You know?
You're not.
I need
actually
to write War and Peace to be.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You're not writing something seriously. It goes back to the age-old scenario of if you write something comedy, then you are somehow writing something lesser. And it's more difficult to write comedy
it's
than
true.
Just to write drama. You know?
Well, yeah, I don't know about that. But, comedy is always my go-to.
Yeah,
But I mean, I also find humor in dark things and sad things. And, I mean, yeah, so I definitely think, it's like, there's not enough, like, sort of joy out there in literature.
Well, it's not just a matter of there not being enough joy, enough complexity to that joy. That happiness has as many different angles as sadness, as misery, as
greed. Agreed.
I'm wondering, you know, what you do to sort of keep an emotion like happiness or a positive emotion and show it from several different cockeyed angles. Is it a matter of just pursuing the concept? Is this why you are driven by sort of a high concept premise for many of these tales? Or?
You know, I think that's an interesting question. I don't know that I am ever really. I mean, you know, frankly, a lot of my writing process is just kind of whatever I'm interested in that day or that year. You know, and this particular, as my life has gotten better, like, oh, happiness. Some people are happy. I'm happy. What? This is an interesting new territory for me to get into. Marriage, you know, that kind of thing. So it's much, you know, my process tends to be much less thought out than that. It tends to be, oh, I see a theme emerging here. Maybe I'll write a few more stories that fit along with this to sort of, so I have something that coheres, hopefully.
I never got to ask you this when we last talked, but I was curious because there is a very conversational or chatty quality to these stories.
Yes.
I almost get the sense that you write the first draft of these all in one great big chunk. Is this true? I'm curious.
I It ranges. It ranges. I certainly don't write a story that just comes out like that. They tend to be shorter versions of what they are. It'll be a shorter draft, and maybe most of the story is there, but it'll only be 4 pages. And then it gets scribbled on and scribbled on and scribbled on.
That's how the perfection occurs.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the other question I had is your concern for mass media. I noticed this throughout many of these stories.
Yes.
I mean, in What Happens When the MyPods Leave Their Milieu, much of the action is actually galvanized around the internet. Shane fired in the form of a terse email. And then Marjorie writes this on her live journal, and lo and behold, it seems to attract Google search results.
Yes.
Therefore, the privacy of these people is invaded by a medium or a form of mass communication.
Yes.
Likewise, in the radio story, we see an attempt to address phobias through a radio show, and it becomes rather problematic. And so I'm wondering, I mean, you're also concerned with reality TV shows.
Yes.
I'm wondering why you feel mass communication is a good kind of prism for many of your stories.
I feel like it very often either dictates people's behavior in a strange way or affects their behavior in a strange way. You know, the guy in the MePod story, all he did was just write a very modest little book that got some attention that he kind of wasn't expecting, and then he ended up in the end got quite a bit of attention that I think, whereas a lot of people seek that out. And like the people in the phobia things, like, or Benny the Zombie, like, why would you go on a talk show or a reality show to solve your problems?
Yeah.
Like, who is that person that does that? That continues to be fascinating to me. You know, I've said this before, but you know, I would love to sit down with Dr. Phil, but not on TV.
Yeah.
So I'm continually interested in how that seems to shape more and more people.
Or rather,
as those media spread to the internet and all these other places where people can be seen.
Well, it's almost as if people seek the media instead of, I guess, some class. It's the new class structure, essentially, that you are now defined very much by how you appear on media or having your 15 minutes.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
yes.
It's interesting because the last time I got a sense that you were a reality TV show junkie, but you know, junkie.
I'm a TV watcher.
But
for sure.
I'm seeing a little bit more questioning here on your part now after this latest collection.
It's more honestly just as my fascination with. It's not so much. I mean, I like good TV and bad TV sort of equally. Mostly because I'm just amazed of the things that people will do on TV. I understand it, and yet I feel like there's something that I'm going to really get at some point that's going to make this make sense to me.
Was it your intent in terms of MePod? It actually has iPod in it.
That was a weird I don't know where that name. It was a very random thing. I just sort of liked the sound of it. That's kind
do you
of
have
all
an iPod?
I do, but I rarely use it.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, this, again, is this notion of like, oh, well, if I go ahead and sign my preferences up to Apple, I will somehow have an identity through a soundtrack to my life. You know?
Yes. I'm not, I listen to music either mostly at home or in the car. My husband is much more the iPod user.
Gotcha. I also wanted to ask you about Promise.
Yes.
Which concerns itself more than any of your stories about the future.
Yes.
And about prognostication. And I'm wondering how this came about. Did you just really want to explore the future in a way that you hadn't in any of your other stories? Or was this just a matter of, I guess, again, the whole married theme?
Well, I don't know if you remember the last story of the previous collection, All This Heavenly Glory, actually is a future story as well.
Oh, that's true.
Football.
Yeah, yeah.
I do kind of think about it now. Actually, my obsession with the future as of very recently, since I realized that we're almost out of oil, is what the future is going to be like without oil. And like, you know, quite literally how we're going to live our lives if we have no cars and no heating and any of this stuff. So that's the next story. But in any case, I think with Promise it was more kind of like the possibility of like, if I were to have children, what kind of a parent would I be?
Yeah.
You know, could I hack it? Could I, you know, would I be able to read a book? And so, you know, my imagination for scary things is pretty good. For envisioning like the bad. But I was trying to sort of take the good and the bad with this imaginary future. So.
And we haven't even talked about Clearview, which is one of my favorite stories in the book. This was interesting to me because you introduced this town, and again, we have the media invaded, but when in the introduction, you point out that it is as green as any college town. And this was interesting to me because green is it's the color that the human eye sees better than any color on the spectrum. So this was interesting that it goes and transmutes into a place where everything is essentially
clear.
I mean, the thing that was very interesting to me is that this is very much written from less from a conceptual angle, more from a perspective angle. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you negotiated that.
You know, again, I sort of approached it, okay, once I had the idea, also inspired by television, I have to say, I saw a commercial with a clear building on it. I was like, what would that be like? I really just kind of put myself in the head of a parent in a small town and trying to see how you would cope with that circumstance. You know, just the way we cope with whatever more realistic circumstances come up. And it ended up presenting things that I hadn't really thought about when I started the story. Like, it's a pretty obvious metaphor in the end.
Yeah.
You know, and the little girl sort of points it out. She's like, talks about, you know, like, I want people to look at me. People stop looking at each other. And they all start much more simple than they coming out.
Well, how did you stumble upon cardboard as the one thing people can see?
Yeah, well, I will say, like, sort of physically speaking, I did have to do a bit of thinking about, in terms of suspension of disbelief and all that kind of thing, because I wanted you to believe it, be there, see it. So I was just trying to think of some substance that maybe you couldn't see through, and it just happened to be that. I wanted it to be something sort of mundane and dull. Could have just as easily been maybe plywood or something. But
the fact that it's cardboard, which is essentially the groundswell upon which America is founded upon, the trucking industry, what's in a Costco, that sort of thing.
There you go.
I suppose endless moving packaging.
Look at all the cardboard.
Exactly. Well, there you go. Yes, cardboard is everywhere. I'm trying to throw as many questions as I can in limited time. So one other question I want to ask you was about this Blue Girl, because this, again, shows something of a variation of this media concentration, but also it's all about judgment. It's about this character who suddenly sees words stamped in block print letters upon her forehead.
Yes.
And this was very interesting to me because this dramatically affects her identity, her ability to be herself, her ability to traverse within this world of ours. You can talk about how judgment has become more of a predominant theme as you have dwelled more upon this idea of media or being stamped or being perceived.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up that word because it's something that I'm exploring even more in subsequent stories that I've been writing because I realize that my judgment of people is particularly people I don't know well, is very often wrong. You know, sometimes I can size people up really well and I think that I know what somebody's all about. I think in other respects, I'm just scratching the surface. And so I'm kind of interested in turning that around a little bit. You know, I have a story that was made into a short film last summer in Chicago called Stealer. And it's about a woman who is an artist on the west side of Chicago. And she starts dating this guy who lives in a high rise downtown. He's very wealthy and kind of a frat boy, and she judges him. But I flipped it around because I'm naturally empathetic to the artist.
Yeah.
But I wanted to find find the non-stereotype in that kind of guy that I perceive to be a certain way.
Yeah.
So that's I'm very interested in like what we see versus what really is.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because many of the men in these stories, they wear baseball caps, they wear glasses.
Yeah.
They have specific looks to them in which we apparently understand who they are, and they're not necessarily who they are. In fact, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about really quick, and that was the fact of most of these men have a tendency to be balding. What's up with that?
I'm sorry.
No. I have no problem. I'm perfectly confident with my balding disposition, I assure you. But
That's the ones who are
the new boyfriends often.
The new boyfriends?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Donovan is...
Donovan?
Yes, yes. And he's great. Donovan's great.
Yeah, he's not
that
guy.
Yeah, that's true, that's true. And Ed, too, seems to be, I believe. That's an interesting test. Yeah. See, again, it was very not thought out at all. Ben, as you saw, has a nice head of hair.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Exactly.
I'm
just trying to, you know, stand up for the bald men in our society. We're good too.
I'm secretly waiting for Ed Harris in my alternate life.
Yeah. Well, I know you have to rush off, but
right.
Thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for being patient.
Oh, yeah.